Thank you, everyone, for coming. This is Enjoying the Temple with Fresh Eyes, and these are my three favorite Mormons. All right, so this session is about Mormon temple experience, that sometimes it can be jarring at first, then inspiring, and eventually repetitive, dull, and perhaps monotonous. So this session, we will be discussing how we might liven temple worship and service. Are there ways of approaching it that can add to life, personal and communal empowerment, and richer views of these experiences? So these three awesome Mormons have their own takes on these things. So first we have Dan Witherspoon, who is the host of Mormon Matters podcast, and a former editor and executive of director of Sunstone. So if there's anyone who hasn't listened to Mormon Matters, I highly recommend.
Me too. No.
Yep. Yeah. They absolutely have a lot of healthy reframings on faith and being an active Mormon, and it's a very healthy podcast for me to listen to. And then we have Jody England Hansen, who is a mixed media artist, occupational empty nester, mama dragon, and LGBTQ activist. Repatriated Utah and a God seeker who hasn't figured any of this out yet. Love it. And then we have Sonia Farnsworth, who is the mother of four daughters and has been a Mormon feminist since the 80s. Woo. She has an MA in communication studies and has taught college level classes in communication theory and academic writing for the past 15 years. So I'll turn it over to Dan.
I'm gonna, do you want to switch places? Sure. just for my part here?
Sure, absolutely. So, oh, yeah.
Let me tell you how this session came together. And some of you will have heard the podcast or perhaps read the article in Sunstone. I wrote an article in Sunstone recently that was called Why Ritual Makes Sense. Because when you look at ritual, it really doesn't make sense a lot of times. Why is it so repetitive? Why is it so boring? And yet, why do people claim or feel a sense of empowerment or some sort of new orientation in the universe after, you know, participating in it? And so I'm going to share maybe just the first, you know, little bit will be over some of that. But I'm going to take today's into, you know, specifically the Mormon endowment and all those kinds of things. But the way this got started was I read the article. Sonia calls me and says, Dan, wow, I love that thing. I've been thinking about stuff too. And we worked out a dinner, right? It took us forever because it was all snowy in the winter when we got all that going there. And don't drive to my house on a night like this. And we'll do it later. And we said, let's put together a panel. And Jody and I, just as being friends for years, I kind of constantly know what she's working on. And this, the three of us felt like we could put together a session that you're really glad that you chose out of all the ones today. So I am going to be the person who provides hopefully the broadest framing. I will have some specific ideas to perhaps get your brains going a little bit differently when you're in the temple. But let me share at least the intentions of the material and my presentation today. So my first intention is to insist and encourage you to more easily enter and move freely within ritual space. I want to convince you that ritual space is completely or very much different from normal chronological space and time and things like that. And I want you to feel free to play within it, to mine it for the type of space and the things that you can learn and participate in there. I want you to enjoy the freedom in and embrace the wisdom of myth, archetype, drama, stylization, repetition, right? And embodied action. I'm hoping to allow for and embrace the collapsing of space and time, to take things that seem set in one period of time or some sort of place and bring them into your own lives or bring them into your ancestors' lives, and just feel free to play all across space and time. I want you to understand liminality and the importance of having immersions in liminality and what Victor Turner calls anti-structure, so that when you go back into structure, when you re-enter structure, there will be some gifts that linger with you as you enter back in. And then finally, to help you notice the gifts of communitas In some ways, it's a little bit harder in the temple than it is in certain other types of rituals and things like that. But communitas is that feeling that comes when all of you as a group have entered in to a ritual or an ordeal or something like this, in which, guess what? Class, status, who's, you know, the president and who's the pauper, you know, all those things are leveled. And to just notice it and to enjoy the gifts of communitas. So that's my goals for presenting these things.
Webster doesn't seem to know what liminality is.
Yes, I'm about to give it to.
Are you going to tell
us? Yeah, right now. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Right now. I think I have a. Well, let's do one thing first. So in Greek, in ancient Greece and things like that, they began to distinguish between two different types of time. We all know, think of time as that steady march, right? That's chronological time, right? Chronos is one of the modes of time. It's the befores, the afters, and things like that. So when we say that something is anachronistic, it means like, oh, this is a law or something that, you know, in a different time or something, it doesn't really match up. Or we could say that something is chronic, right? If you have a chronic condition, what does that generally mean?
It's
going to continue, because it's a repetitive sort of thing. But they understood it actually came from originally in rhetoric studies. They recognized that there was these times in which, well, I guess times, there were these moments that could feel out of time. You know what I mean? They originally came from the Kairos moment was in an argument when you're doing debate or in rhetoric. It was the opportune time that just sits there and is ready for you to offer the killer argument. You know, here's the exact point to make this. But it began to be thought of as pregnant with possibilities. The time that's sort of out of time and that anything allows. And so one of the things about ritual and one of the things about temple space that I'm hoping to say to you is this is deliberately going to get you, if you'll let it, truly away from the cares of your day, truly away from the march of time and things like this, and hopefully help you enter into something where something might break through in a new way that your normal structures and everything really facilitate well. So, parts of a ritual. Arnold Van Gennep wrote a great book called The Rites of Passage. Victor Turner took the stages that he identified and put them in a larger model with different sorts of naming and things like this, including liminality, which I'll share in a second. So basically, we think of time, this is now, and that's later. When you enter into a ritual, or enter into ritual space, you separate yourself from that normal flow of time. So let's think, we'll play mostly with the temple here today, okay? What's the first thing you do when you enter the temple after showing, you know, I'm qualified for this rite, you know, and that's actually a part in the, you know, rites of passages and things like this, you know, all those things. But after doing that, what do?
Change
your clothes. You might more, you know, instead of Dave, you know, hey, Dave, from my ward, Brother Smith, or, you know, whatever. So, like, you begin to change language possibility, things like this. But you are basically saying to yourself, I'm ready for a different experience than what I just left. So through various acts of separation, and honestly, if you think of prayer, you might just change posture, right? You might go from sitting to kneeling, something like that. Other things, you might enter into certain types of language, the prayer language, the stylized, you know, prayer language. It's something that says, I'm not in normal conversation here. You know, it's not like, thee, God, you're so there up there. I mean, it's actually the most intimate language is those these and thous when King James was, you know, in about and stuff like that. But I'm just saying there's so many ways, and my article in Sunstone talks about all those kinds of things. Liminality, though, is the key gift of ritual. The word liminality comes from the term limen, L-I-M-E-N, and in Greek and stuff like that, it means the threshold or the doorway. Okay, so basically, when you're in liminal phase of a ritual, so it's by far the dominant phase.
you're stepping out of not only regular time, you possibly are going to be in different structures where different rules apply, various things like this, and you're going to be free from some of the brain chatter and some of the other things that dominate your normal sort of consciousness. And then at the end of a ritual, you reintegrate back into society, back into your normal life, whatever it would be. And you hope, I really mean to redo this. I drew this stupid line here, and it's not very well done, but I've been using it on a couple of presentations that I did. Because as you re-enter, can you see I tried to make this a more gradual line before it sort of ends, you know, at the same spot? What we hope from a ritual is that you re-enter the normal flow, your normal life, with some effects from having been in that ritual space and time, okay? So that's what we're trying to do there. So some of the language that we have for, we're in our day-to-day experience, we're in structure, we're in chronos, time, liminal phase. Some of the language you'll find is anti-structure. This idea that we might be betwixt and between two different worlds, you know, heaven and earth, the veil is thinner, however you'd want to say there. Here, it's going to be dominated instead of roles that you play in society or something like this. You'll move into archetypes. The characters and the things in these plays are not fully fleshed out. You know, they wouldn't make a good novel, right? No ritual that you see probably has a good novelized characterization. It's because these characters are playing archetypes. Archetypes of, you know, the human being making the hero's journey, a person embodying the archetype of evil forces, or the forces that want you to stay small and not realize your full identity, or things like this. So it's always an archetypal or primal energies. In liminal phase, it's really easy to see on a mission or in the military or something like this, the liminal phase, this time that you're on a mission, or you're in the military, what's the army trying to do for you? Break you down out of that cocky, individual, rugged kind of guy, and what are they trying to do? Mold you into a group. You know, they're going to break you down before building you back up, right? Kind of thing. On a mission, you're separated, I got my haircut. I wear these clothes. I have this badge. I call you Elder instead of Dave. I don't know why Dave's on my mind. That's a name. various things like this. And in that liminal phase, different rules apply to you. You have fewer choices, but the choices all have that ability to kind of sing to yourself and say, wow, these are archetypal type choices. These are, you know, am I going to be outward focused or inward focused? Am I going to, you know, be loving in response? Or, you know, it's always those types of things that happen. When you get set apart for a calling, you can think of the time that you're the bishop. You're, you know, these kinds of things. You're different, and society's going to react to you differently when they know that liminal phases, and when your time is done, you'll reintegrate back into the society, but with that new identity. So if it was a boyhood ritual or a womanhood ritual, you leave as a child, they separate you, you learn the gnosis of womanhood or maleness or the roles that you're going to play in society, and then when you go back, society now recognizes you as what? In the adult world, the adult community with different things. But it's always important that this liminal phase breaks you down and does it. Communitas, I mentioned, is that feeling of oneness. I mean, your best friends in the world are the people that went through this ordeal with you. And you got to know them without their pretensions, things like this, because of all those things. And so communitas could do it. And again, kairos time, that time when possibly, when you're betwixt and between, where thoughts and ideas that get crowded out by sensory images, sensory things, or various day-to-day things. So then again, we return to structure, we return to chronos time, but hopefully at a higher, more elevated level, at least for a while. So what is the one thing about ritual? You get to do it again, right? Every 7 days, we got one day that's separate from the other days. And every day, we have a ritual, you know, every one of those Sundays, we have rituals and things like that where we get to go back into this place and without, you know, just to have those moments where we think of stuff like this. And so the beautiful thing about ritual is that cyclical, repetitive things whenever you do it. No one can stay in liminality for long. The closest we probably get is in monasteries and cloistered environments or things like that. But even those are very structured after a while and things like this. It's just impossible to do it. So that is, I think, the only repetitiveness from my articles and things. So let's now apply these to the temple stuff. Why a creation drama? Right? How many of you go, went to that temple the first time and go, whoa, the creation. And every time I go there, it's going to be this 15 or 20 minutes of rehearsal of the creation drama. So I'm just going to read out loud, read along with me, please, a longer quote, but it'll give you a sense. Every society, at least, I mean, not every ritual follows the creation drama or the original characters or, you know, how the world or the cosmos was formed, but many of them do. And there's a very good reason for it. So from Lawrence Sullivan, used to run Harvard's religion department. The fundamental conditions are conceived in terms of the beginning, the first order, the primordium, the basic structure of appearance, hiddenness, inchoateness, differentiation, uniqueness, multiplicity, language, gesture, stasis, and change provide those footholds for our imagination. When we're in ritual space, the imagination is very, very important. By their very presence in the imagination and in the beginning, these principal realities, envisioned in particular symbols, condition all subsequent forms of contingent being itself. Can you tell this was a scholarly book? Right? But are you catching on here? It says, the universe has an integrity of its own because its presence first takes shape in the images of the beginning. So however a society or however we think of the beginning of life or the beginning of ourselves or the beginning of our family or something, that is a primary shaper. The creative primordium, this would be, as God says, yonder is better and organized or something along those lines, is an ordered progression of powerful events that affect the most significant change that has ever been wrought, the appearance of the world. By depicting the greatest contrast in modes of being, creation reveals what change means. Creation accounts provide the basis for the imagination, thought, and reflection. That is, for the ordering processes that make the cosmos a home to humankind. There's a lot to go on there. And in what may seem sometimes to us as boring and repetitive and things like that, if we can get away from the details, am I really supposed to remember what's on this day versus that day and things like that? But to say, the gods called the universe together. Or, you know, and what were these processes like? Was it like, I am going to grab this clay and mold the world together? Or were there other things there? As you watch this, all those things will, they play in these ideas here of, oh, how does God operate? How does God operate in my life? There's all sorts of things that you can do with this sort of sense of being in the creation. So the power of having archetypal characters who make archetypal choices. A Native American saying, to learn the god, you must dance the god. So if you've seen kachinas and Native American ceremony and things like this, it's by actively participating in the dance that those who participate says, I feel now the creative energy. I feel now, you know, what it would be like to call the world into creation through my words or through my dance, through my singing, things like this. You can't learn things unless you embody them in some ways and put them within you. So the key, like probably insight, maybe you've heard me talk about a little bit here and there in various things, is let's look at the endowment from that whole, what it really is. You know, let's take the 10,000 foot view. And what is it? It's an ascension story, right? Let's look at where it begins. Through the washing and the anointing, it begins by telling you what? Exactly who you are. These are your gifts. These are your rights. I wash you. I promise you that all these things are yours by birthright, that you can have these things. You are divine. You start with the greatest knowledge of who you are, but guess what? You end up in the garden. Garden certainly is a liminal state where we understand ourselves as special to God, you know, all those different things, but it begins to be more theoretically. Later in the garden story, as you know, God gives commandments and things like this, you understand what God's asking, but you're not really 100% sure. Eventually, though, in the drama, as well as in our own lives, I think, you know, can you kind of take this from your own pre-immortal journey into mortality and things like that? This all plays. We lose this identity in this lone and dreary world. The concerns of our body. All of a sudden, wow, these senses are overwhelming me with things. I've got hormones are raging. I've got, physical aches and pains and things like this. They all become confused, and our core identity gets covered over a little bit. And we're not always in that firm remembrance of who we truly are. We start satisfying. Phil McLemore spoke on the very first day. He says, "Little Phil." You know, instead of understanding himself as Big Phil, you know, the full-on thing, we start to say, "Oh, well, this is me," and it's a much, much smaller, you know, version of ourselves than it was there. So the concerns of the body, of work, of jobs, of relationships, oh, Jody, you're driving me crazy, you know, I can't think of myself as divine because it's you who are messing me up, or, you know, all those different things.
It's
everything comes in and this covers over that stuff for us. Our language limits us, you know, and so we understand that language can't allow full comprehension. It just doesn't. It's symbols, right? It's words that mean something. I'm throwing some gestures in here, and I'm probably, hopefully, not just driving you crazy to distraction because I'm up here almost looking like I'm dancing. But I'm working on, you know, through these different ways of having that language be even more powerful, to give you a sense or a feel for it, and not just that. But we still know that language will never get us there. That's why we got to start doing some body things. We got to actually work with our bodies. So, but because of these things, the temple, the endowment tells us, you've forgotten some stuff, so let's send messengers. You know, I want to send some things, messengers. I'm going to have stories that come out, myths, and other symbolic means that can guide us back to that full remembering that we of who we are, that we had lost and had covered over. And so I hope I'm letting you draw many conclusions from your own temple experiences without always explicitly doing it. So then another thing to recognize, as we face various archetypal choices and we choose well, again, at the beginning of the endowment, consider yourselves as if you are the people in this drama, right? We see them making choices. We see them being taught. We see them. So as we think about this, but these are always very archetypal choices. And as we choose well, in other words, we're willing to make a covenant, we do make that covenant, and we mark that covenant through a ritual and means. Anytime there's a covenant, no matter what it is, you do something physically, and you gain some sort of insight or gnosis that marks this. So now, through these different covenants, we now not only, oh yeah, I went through that one time, but it's like you say, oh, I remember when I covenanted this because I got this sign, I got this token. There's a before and an after, right? Anytime you make something, a big change in life, it's so important to have rituals to mark them. And so in women's spirituality work, people are creating rituals all the time right now because they want to fully embody their intentionality, to say, I'm a new person, I'm reborn into this or that thing that I have desired. And through that, and as we think through the atonement, or excuse me, the endowment, as we make those covenants and as we do this, we are beginning to ascend. Remember, I call this an ascension story. Through moving into the terrestrial, then the celestial states of understanding and empowerment. I'm almost done. Liminal, anti-structure, anything goes. You know, I mean, I've been not anything goes, you know, everyone pull up a cigarette or something in the temple and all of a sudden, but I'm saying within you, the temple is working, ritual is working to get you out of this head. I mean, some of the language it's stylized, some of the repetition might even be there deliberately to bore you. Because then, as oh, I've heard this before, but what does that do? It frees you up, you know, to start saying, you know, is there something here that I can grab or something? So I want you to feel free to play, and I've just got a few examples to just sort of set the possibilities in motion here. Immerse yourself in the various roles. Okay? Most of us guys, what's the only role that we're playing there in the temple?
Adam.
Women, most of the time we only, you probably likely saying, oh, I'm Eve. Try a reversal. Men, go through the endowment, imagining yourself as Adam.
As Eve.
As Eve, and vice versa. Imagine yourself as the Father. Imagine yourself as the Son, as Michael, as the messengers, as Satan.
You think that hit bug me less?
Oh, I don't know. I'm just saying. But until you do that, until you play, you know, and imagine yourself and sort of, you know, so you're not going to really be able to fully dance Satan in this case, or, you know, those kind of actions, because you're not really doing the covenants and things that he wants you to do. But you're freeing yourself up to see the world differently, right? Let's say, you know, left eye, right? I'm always, you know, with my right eye closed, I'm only seeing here, but I'm seeing slightly different over here or something like that when I imagine it. How many of you do loving kindness meditations or something like that? What are you trying to do there? You're trying to say, what would this situation look like from this person that has harmed me, has hurt me, or something, or somebody who I know is struggling, but I don't know what it is. And so you try to put yourself in their shoes and their roles. So that's just one of the fun things that you could do, possibly, to freshen up the temple for you. You are in the world of archetypes, folks, so unpin the situations. Take the action out of the garden, out of the primitive world, and into the situations you face today. The things that your parents face, your ancestors face, or our others were in the past or are facing today. Feel free to say, well, we already know it's anachronistic. Who are the visitors? They're coming from a far different space and time within Scripture and things like this there. So you already know that within Joseph Smith, you have permission to say, this isn't history. You know, these are the archetypal messengers of Jesus Christ coming to instruct us. The Word of God is being presented, the ideal situations and things to do. As you're there, think about the various temperaments at play. And this is a fun one that I only heard recently from Natasha Helfer Parker. Have you ever thought, for instance, that Adam, when Eve takes the fruit, you know, because first of all, the tempter came where? To who first? No, I'm a rule follower. I'm an iron rod Mormon, right? You know, can you imagine that with Adam sort of playing that role? But Eve had the perspective that says, oh, I want to know for myself. Yeah, she understood the theoretical or something like that. Those are two different temperaments. But guess what? As soon as she took it, and Adam hadn't yet, what do you think? Is that a mixed faith marriage? Can you see how unpinning it from their situation to situations that you're in or something like this? And we have wonderful there, a very good choice that Adam made. What did he choose? He chose relationship over dogma, over obedience. He says, I will be with her. So can you see that when you're in these archetypal situations, you know? Will you sell your tokens for money? Famous one, right? That's back from Masonry. You know, I advanced to this degree of Masonry. I know how to do these things. I got to go tell the paymaster. How else am I going to show him that I know this amount of Masonry, and he should pay me higher than the other guy, right? That's what that's all comes from. But the idea is what? I was given a gift. I have an acknowledgement. I have empowerment. Am I willing to give those up for the mess of pottage or the things like that? These are archetypal things. And so take them out of the Garden of Eden. Take them out of the lone and dreary world. Put them into your own lives. Allow yourself to play with gender. I talked about class, et cetera, to embrace experimentation with a deeper you, a deeper other. Notice while there, as well as when you leave, your energy, your feelings, your thoughts about yourself and others in the room. Do you feel greater empowerment, bigger perspectives and/or benefits from the collapse of social distances and things like this? When you come out of the ritual, when you come out of an immersion that told you you were God to begin with, and that you had fallen and you'd forgotten that, but do you make your way back to welcome into the presence of God? you know, thou good and faithful servant, that language is there. When you think of what that final token, you know, says, you've done the ascension. That's got to feel great when you walk out. You don't have to believe in Adam and Eve. You don't have to believe in a little Garden of Eden. But how does that feel to you, to taste to you, that you were shown? I'm the pauper who actually is the prince, and I forgot that, and now I have restored to that kind of knowledge. But just sense all the things that have been happening to you in the ritual, and notice your energy. I think you'll feel, I think the temple will be neat from that. I think I have one more slide. As we re-enter a chronological time, normal structures, let's remember, and this is from Alfred North Whitehead, but I think it really does bring things home. He says, the true method of discovery, you know, anything, is like the flight of an aeroplane. And he's writing, he's from England, and aeroplane spelled that way back in the early 20th century. It starts from the ground of a particular observation. It starts from regular life. It starts from structure. It makes a flight in the thin air of imaginative generalization. In liminality, I said the imagination is important, right? Let it play. Let it generalize. Let it take it out of the specific thing and say, man, how can I take this general principle, these general archetypes, and put them into my life or something like that? And then it again lands for renewed observation. You come back into time and space with our faculties, our observation rendered acute by the thinking stuff. So in some ways we're saying suspend your normal brains, suspend your normal things, but guess what? They have a role to play. But now they've been fed all this imaginative tossing and turning and role-playing and thinking about others and thinking about our lives and what we felt and all those things. Our life will be sharper, more in focus. We'll discover our values. We'll want to live them better. Maybe we'll disagree with some of the values that the other things show, but you'll be sharper in front of it. So I'm just going to close with that. And I hope that some of this at least will be things to think about next time you go and to play, and hopefully that is a fresh eyes for your experience.
No, I'm going to sit. Well, I'm glad you mentioned the notion of playing with the ideas and symbols, because the paper here is really the result of me doing a lot of playing with it. And I'm sharing that with you today. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints does not teach just one doctrine of gender. It teaches two. The proclamation on the family illustrates one, and the temple illustrates another. The two doctrines are diametrically opposed. The proclamation's approach to gender is conditional, traditional, and well-known. The temple's is mystical, transcendent, and obscured by symbolism, but worth exploring.
Can you all hear in the back? Yeah, I don't know.
Is there a microphone?
There isn't. I think this is just a normal classroom, so can you just try a little louder? I'm just guessing. I'm seeing some people back there.
Everybody always complains about my voice.
Maybe you could scoot up.
You can just read it right from the front or
right.
Something. If you don't mind getting up. Yeah, that's great.
No.
Super.
Okay.
I'll stand
for here.
Do you want a chair?
I think I'd probably be able to project better.
Okay.
Shall I start over?
Yeah, even scoot up more. You can scoot up to the first row there.
Okay. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, how am I doing?
Great.
Okay. Does not teach just one doctrine of gender. It teaches two. The proclamation on the family illustrates one, and the temple illustrates another. The two doctrines are diametrically opposed. The proclamation's approach to gender is conditional, traditional, and well-known. The temple's is mystical, transcendent, and obscured by symbolism, but worth exploring for the higher wisdom needed to nourish and sustain each other and a church in distress. The proclamation's version of gender as an essential characteristic of individual, premortal, mortal, and eternal identity creates an inescapable heterosexual precondition for exaltation. Elder Russell M. Ballard has compared the proclamation to General Moroni's title of liberty. Bonnie L. Oscarson, general president of the church's Young Women, has described it as revelatory, and church leaders regularly praise it in general conference and church publications to establish its preeminence, if not as literal revelation, at least as virtual revelation. Compared to teachings on gender in conservative religions generally, the proclamation portrays the most restrictive vision of gender I'm aware of in Judeo-Christian theology. Its inflexible definition of premortal masculinity and femininity has wedged LGBT Mormons with exquisite tightness between the rock of revelation and the hard place of their unyielding orientation. As Tyler Glenn, lead singer of the rock band Neon Trees, recently said to a KUTV news reporter, "I am gay, and I struggle weekly to find my place in this world because I struggled for so long to find my place in God's plan." To put it bluntly, for those of us who are LGBT or who love someone who is, the proclamation's definition of gender is the gender of our discontent. And this despite church efforts to put it into perspective. LDS officials have spent two decades earnestly offering a conveyor belt of rationales and justifications for the proclamation's intractable link between heterosexuality and exaltation. But their efforts have been cold comfort. Today, Mormon gays who wish to remain in full church fellowship must live what a friend said to me was a monk's life of chastity, while other Latter-day Saints gallingly glorify heterosexual sex as love's ultimate expression and accept a soteriology that shuts gays out of heaven unless they deny their lived experience. A literal interpretation of the Temple Endowment supports the proclamation's version of gender. The Garden of Eden narratives, both in the Temple and the Old Testament, are commonly understood as prescriptions for complementary gender roles and prototypes for heterosexual marriage. The only problem is that the Temple is not meant for literal interpretations. The endowment's rituals, symbolisms, allegory, and metaphor are not information. They are invitations to deeper meanings and mysteries that require a certain amount of mental traction and willingness to surrender to our higher minds. As Emily Dickinson declared in one of her mystical poems, "By intuition, mighty things assert themselves." A symbolic interpretation of the temple's creation myth does not endorse gender roles. It presents them as a cursed consequence of the fall that one must transcend, not embrace, to achieve salvation. The Hebrew name Adama has many meanings, among them plurality and unity, human or mankind. Thus, Adam is not a man but a creature that represents women as well. And though our highly gendered culture makes it difficult to think of Adam as both male and female, even symbolically, that is exactly what the temple narrator instructs us to do when he says, "Brethren and sisters, this couple at the altar represents all of you as if at the altar." This does not mean that men should think of themselves as Adam and women should think of themselves as Eve. It means that individuals should see themselves as a continuum of both male and female elements, or as Paul Toscano described in his book, The Serpent and the Dove, quote, "Each individual is a compound of male and female elements in dynamic and complementary opposition," close quotes. The King James Bible supports the notion of the human spirit as a fusion of male and female components in Genesis 1, verse 27, where it states, "God created man in his own image, male and female created he them." Church leaders and conservative Christians see this scripture as proof of gender's importance. They believe it means that when God created our spirits, he made them either male or female. However, the verse could just as easily mean that God made mankind in his own image because he was, by definition, both male and female. And though the verse refers to God as he, these masculine pronouns are just as likely the default male pronouns feminists complain about as having rendered women invisible. And while scripture frequently refers to the Creator as Father, it describes God using many female allegories as well. Other aspects of the Garden of Eden narrative sustain the notion of human beings as a compound of male and female. In the story, Adam falls into a deep sleep. While he is in that state, God removes a rib and fashions it into Eve. This infers that prior to his surgery, Adam was both Adam and Eve, because Eve was still within him. Once God removed Eve, the male and female aspects of Adam no longer formed a compound in one. And Adam and Eve begin an existence as separate beings. In this disconnected state, they begin to make bad decisions. Eve follows Satan's advice and eats the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, even though God told her not to. And Adam succumbs to Eve's threat about being a lone man in the Garden of Eden and eats too. As God expels him, God expels them from his presence for bad behavior, he applies the well-known gendered curse of Genesis 2 that predicts painful labor and subservience for women and wretched, insecure breadwinning for men. Since gender roles emerge as a curse and are associated with the fall, they can hardly be seen as a crucial element of exaltation. As the story progresses, Adam and Eve reunite in the prayer circle and make their symbolic journey back into God's presence through the veil, symbolizing redemption. The late Max Skousen, whose detailed interpretation of the temple ceremony is available online, describes Adam and Eve's reunification in the prayer circle as, quote, the wholeness of the individual with each male and female couple welding the circle into one complete whole, close quote. Following the prayer circle, the reconstituted initiatives return to the presence of God, reversing the fall and transcending gender altogether. This symbolic interpretation of the temple's Eden narrative offers several advantages. The first is that men and women are no longer in a complementary relationship. Despite biological differences, spiritually, every child of God is a genderless amalgam of masculine and feminine. This sheds new light on the possibility for female ordination. The second implication is that traditional gender roles are neither innate nor relevant to salvation. One can break with traditional roles without being warned that one's deviation will lead to social chaos. The third implication is that gender complementarity is no longer an argument against same-sex marriage or a cause of theological confusion over how transsexuals and intersexes fit into the plan of salvation. Without gender, genitals are not the governing principle of exaltation. And as Paul Toscano has noted, this concept of male and female should not be interpreted as privileging heterosexuality over homosexuality or insisting upon the static nature of one's bodily form or sex. Male and female should not be imagined as merely material and static, but as spiritual and dynamic, fluid principles in a continuing dance of reversals, a spinning yin and yang that defy any settled description. Close quotes. To put it briefly, temple symbolism opens the way for the LGBT community's entrance into the celestial kingdom and makes room for Latter-day Saints to explore the possibility that same-sex attraction and gender dysphoria are not grotesque lifestyle choices we cannot tolerate because they undermine the traditional family. Since the temple endowment is the high holy ordinance of Mormonism and offers the meat rather than the milk of the gospel, it makes sense to believe it would trump the proclamation as an articulation of gender's relationship to the plan of salvation. But even if that weren't the case, the proclamation has several weaknesses that place it in a one-down position to the endowment anyway. First, it is that its claims about gender and sex did not emerge from direct revelation and were never part of canonized scripture. They originated in an essay by James B. Talmadge published in the October 1914 edition of the Young Woman's Journal. In that essay, Talmadge theorized that people were made male and female in the preexistence and would continue after death in both the disembodied and resurrected states. He also speculated that the body takes the form as male and female according to the sex of the spirit whose appointment it is to tenant the body. Today, we know that a percentage of people are born with genital ambiguity, sometimes referred to as intersex identity, and the theory collapses under its own weight. Fortunately, Talmadge's speculation was never canonized, as far as I can tell, remained forgotten for decades. However, it came in handy when church leaders needed a document to serve as a statement against same-sex marriage during their response to the Hawaii same-sex marriage case. According to Dave Bannock's thoughtful essay, Rethinking the Proclamation, Dr. Carrie Miles put her finger on the issue when she noted that the proclamation did not respect scriptural truths and was written to express what the standard works did not say more than what they did say. She said, no biblical passage or uniquely LDS scripture demands marriage and family as essential for salvation or requires the sexual division of labor. Jesus, in fact, says that following him will set family members at war with one another. Close quotes. Today, although the temple is Mormonism's most sacred liturgy, the proclamation is matted and framed in millions of LDS living rooms. There, it expresses Mormon doctrine heavily influenced by evangelical and pro-family notions about gender's critical role in family life and as a remedy for America's decline into chaos. And though social scientists observe gender as a social construct that changes over time and cultures, the proclamation's gender is virtually baked into us in premortality as if it were the linchpin in the Creator's plan for the eternal destiny of his children, and therein lies the problem. This inescapable nature of gender has brought great personal pain to many Latter-day Saints. It gives no quarter to the equally inflexible gender diversity that is reality for thousands of LGBT Latter-day Saints. If the church needs anything, it needs a kinder, gentler gender. If Mormonism hopes to stop brutalizing its LGBT members, and I know it does, temple meetings can, as Paul Toscano says, be tapped as a wellspring of messianic renewal. I'm optimistic about that possibility because I see significant shifts away from the conservative Christian Mormonism of the proclamation to the temple meetings. Dan Wotherspoon explored the temple ritual and why ritual makes sense. That was published in the fall 2016 issue of Sunstone. Jody England Hansen has been encouraging members to interpret the temple figuratively for quite some time. David G. Pace, prize-winning essayist and author, wove temple symbols into his 2015 novel, Dream House on Golan Drive. He told me he couldn't write a Mormon novel without including aspects of its mythology because, and I quote, "The temple ritual is the liturgy of Mormons. It has to be part of the story we tell ourselves and others. When we fail to understand it, we have no answer when anti-Mormons present it, only in terms of religious pornography in lurid productions such as the Godmakers. And when that happens, we denigrate one of the most sacred aspects of our faith.
Well, if it's okay with you, can you hear me if I'm speaking from here? Because I'm reading this off of my laptop, and there's no podium to set it on. I really appreciate everything that's been said. I gave a paper yesterday called They, Them, Theirs, Finding God on the Spectrum, and it says a lot of the similar reasoning and history that we have, but mostly the intense destruction of our conversations about binary gender. And so mostly I'm just going to share some things about a process, a decades-long process of my experience in the temple that is so contradictory to this binary gender conversation, and especially many aspects that I find so destructive. Recently, we moved. My husband and I lived for 10 years in Colorado, but recently moved back to Salt Lake City. And the last year that we were in Colorado, for the first time in 45 years, I was without a ward or a state calling. Some pretty awful things had happened because of, you know, decisions by my new bishop and stake president. But there was no, you know, formal description of why or anything, but I was continued to be for the fourth year an ordinance worker in the temple. Loved it, absolutely loved doing that. It was kind of a saving grace for that last year that I was there because of my community there. When we returned to Salt Lake, the home that we bought is in the Salt Lake Temple District, and during the regular closing for the deep cleaning, my husband and I volunteered to go there and clean. And because I'm willing to climb a ladder, and we had the assignment to clean the big chandeliers in the main hallway. And for those of you who have been there, it's really a glorious hallway, and not glorious in the sense of some of the new opulent temples. Glorious for me because my ancestors built this. And so there I was at the top of a ladder, and Mike was bracing the base of it. And there was a ladder next to me, a woman from also from our stake, much younger than I am. She was at the top of the other ladder, her husband bracing that. And we were cleaning the chandelier up there. And as we were up there, gradually removing dust from this chandelier, and it got brighter and brighter. And she and I were talking, and she just started talking to me about her gay brother and how grateful she is that he is in a place where he's doing well and healthy. And eventually she had to leave, and I was up there, and as I continued to clean in this hallway that had been built by my ancestors, becoming brighter as I wiped things off of these crystals, I sang Amazing Grace as my husband steadied the ladder. Everything is figurative in the temple. And it is there that we learn how to make everything figurative elsewhere in a way that is powerful. And that's what I want to talk with. Because as I was there, I thought about so many things that connect us rather than things that rip us apart. And I understand that the temple can be so triggering. I get that. I've had those moments in there. I am not here to tell you should be there. I'm not here to tell you have to find a great experience. I'm just sharing something. And as I've been in the temple, and now I'm an ordinance worker there in the Salt Lake Temple, and no matter what my assignments are as I move around the much larger space than compared to the last temple I served in, I think of my ancestors, and I think of those that will come after me, and the connections that we have, and what draws us together. And so I want to share some ways of doing that bring more power to my life in all ways. So why is it that some can find peace and comfort and inspiration and even revelation in the temple, and others are offended and repulsed and triggered or even traumatized? And I can't answer that, because I really do think, just like I say, there are as many different kinds of Mormons as there are Mormons, there are as many different kinds of genders as there are people, and there are as many different paths to follow as there are people, but not one is more right or true than any other. And when it comes to the temple, I think there are as many different ways to experience it as there are people. So I've attended the temple since I received my endowments when I was 25. So that's 35 years ago. And when I felt a desire to attend the temple, I just went and asked my bishop for a recommend. I hadn't gone on a mission. I wasn't engaged. And so I went, and I did temple prep, and I really appreciate those who helped me prepare. One of them was my sister, who's here, and she told me not to forget my gloves so I wouldn't get rope burns on my hands. And I was really appreciative of that. By the way, there are no ropes in the temple.
You're evil, Jennifer.
Yeah. So if there were any who tried to tell me what I was supposed to think or feel, I didn't really take that to heart. I don't know if it's because I was obnoxious or I'd already learned that or what. And I really appreciate a friend of mine who told me, look, when you're there, just, you know, and something is said and you just want to think about it a while and not listen to the rest, go ahead, do it. You know, don't worry about anything. And I especially remember talking with my dad, and he told me quite a bit about the process and the ritual aspects, and talking about the power of figurative learning. And then he asked me to look at it as a story about me. He said, "That is you. That is you up there, Adam and Eve, and everyone. Don't worry about seeing it as a play about some actual historical event. This is you." Again, everything is figurative. So, you know, this has been addressed already. And I really appreciated that. Since I was already beginning to have the habit of not having to believe anything that wasn't true. And I think this is something we need to start repeating more. I remember hearing this when I was younger. There is nothing about anything, including the church, that you have to believe if it's not true. So let that sink in a little bit. You don't have to believe anything that's not true. So what determines truth? And I also had already been practicing quite a bit that just because someone, a teacher, a leader, general authority, anything, said something, it did not mean I had to agree. So I started to see the temple as a great place to go for meditation and to remove distractions. As Dan explained, get the noise down. Just remove the noise and see what happens. So I, you know, and at that point I was learning about, there had been many changes that had occurred in the endowment ceremony. And I also was learning about the connection it had to many other things. So since that time, I've had long periods of time when I've attended rarely, periods of time when I kind of attended regularly, and when, you know, I would hardly go at all, because all I could think about were the parts that were sexist or seemed to, I just, why do they have that in there? It has nothing to do with what this is about. And so I also began to notice that during those times, I would really get frustrated in every part of my life where it just had very sexist traditions, cultures, language, all kinds of things that we just take for granted and don't acknowledge the impact it has on us. So I began to realize, this is not just there. This is everywhere. What am I going to do about this? Am I going to go everywhere and be angry and frustrated all the time? What am I going to do? But then about 8 or 9 years ago, I felt this consistent need to begin attending the temple every week. And the way it came is I felt like my dad was just talking to me during these moments and just telling me every week, the temple, just trust me on this, trust me. And I had ignored a lot of the things that I later realized were really good advice from him when he was alive. So I decided that now he's dead, if he's trying to get through to me, let's just at least check this out. So I started just saying, I'm going to do this. I'm going to go to the temple every week. The difference was I went without some kind of feeling of obligation. I just went to see what would happen. If I really felt that this would be a good thing, then just let's see what it is. Let's just see what happens. I didn't worry about what I liked or didn't like or what was true or not. And then I began to realize there is nothing there that is true. There is absolutely nothing there that is inherently true. I pictured my father and where I imagine he is now, which I can't, I don't have the language for. But in whatever place beyond the veil, with perspective about all the culture and bias and all the history and all the messiness, what would he see that's available for me there that could make a difference? So what in the temple transcended culture and bias and time? What was there? Years ago, I saw this documentary about a woman who went on a pilgrimage to Japan, to this monastery that was just took so much to reach. And the last stage, like this ritual, you have to go through these ritual things, even to hike this distant mountain to get to this monastery. And the camera was allowed to follow her to a certain point, and she has to divest herself of so much. And then the camera can't follow her anymore. And she continues on to the last stage. And the only thing she would write about me, write about this, is, "My sleeve is wet with tears shed from joy for what I have seen." And that's all. This is the kind of sacredness that this experience has brought me. But it's my experience. It doesn't have to be anyone else's. During this time of having powerful growth, I also came to see very deeply it can never be compelled. Anyone who says you've got to go to the temple or through this or here, you've got to go because that's the only way that you'll have this, it can never happen anywhere. This happened because I was ready to put myself in a place where I could receive what I could not imagine and what I can now not really describe. But I do have new eyes, and the temple is just one place where I've learned that. So how do you approach with new eyes? As I mentioned, I don't look for truth in the temple. I don't let anyone else tell me what the truth is. And as a temple worker, I can promise you that in the training films, we are told, if someone comes and asks us, what does this mean? We are not to tell them the meaning. Not because it's secret, not because we don't have it. It's because we can't tell them what it means. They are to get their own meaning. That's the truth they find. The temple ritual is there for you to shut everything out and go through this process and the repetition where you are in a place where the meaning, the truth, whatever it is that can be yours and only yours comes to you. So if someone isn't telling you what it means, it's not, you know, technically in my mind, it's because they can't. We cannot tell each other what it means. It is part of the journey that each of us has. And that is the place of symbolic and ritual learning. So Dan went through, you know, what can be powerful about that. When Mike and I traveled to Egypt last year, and there we were in these, you know, 5,000-year-old tombs, and we're looking at them, we're going, well, that really is the ritual of the temple up there on the tomb walls. You know, we'd heard about that, but there we were seeing it. So again, this idea that it's somehow inherently true and it's only ours and it's only there, I've heard for a long time, no, that's not the case. But through my travels and learning about other cultures, there are all these other places where what is available through this temple ritual is depicted, is told, is written about, and is in other rituals. So just like scriptures and revelations and conference talk or the political opinions or anything, or the supposed well-meaning message of your home teacher. The temple ritual is not a script from God that was handed to Joseph Smith. It is an ancient ritual about a universal human process. And again, we've heard about sinking into it and learning about it. In this place, there just because you are there to do it, it's an opportunity to see what is there. Another thing that I do is see that the temple is here for me. I am not here for the temple. It is a building. It's not some spoiled child that I have to coddle and please and somehow match myself up with to meet the demands of it. And yet, somehow we behave like that. It's not of any value if I have to somehow cram myself into an expectation that someone else has come up with. Just let it be what it is. Recently, a friend was talking to me about how hard it is for her because she wants to be there for loved ones who are in the temple or receiving their endowments or getting married, and yet she happens to have a bishop that has decided she can't have a recommend. And so she goes and she's outside the temple, and it's really difficult for her, and boy, am I... This is a really tough thing for me. I think we need to rethink a lot of things about what we do to split families up in order to have families forever. I think it's ridiculous. This is one of the things I said is, look, anytime that I'll come and sit with you outside the temple. We'll create outside temple activities. We'll create, you know, the formal portraits that everyone takes, temple portraits. We'll do outside the temple portraits. We'll get a little portable, I don't know, if you drink coffee, a coffee stand or something like that. We'll have our outside the temple activities because it's not about the temple. It is about relationships. Find out what you can do that breaks free of some idea that you've got to cram yourself into something about that. Let the temple be there for you, whether you are entering it or not. There is nothing in the temple that is inherently bringing anyone salvation. We like to, as human beings, we love to think, oh good, here, you know, if I say this this many times and do this this many times and check this off, I got it. I've made it. That's what we do. We love doing it. And it's not just this culture. We have, as a culture, kind of done that to the temple, kind of made that the checklist. There is nothing inherent in there that will bring you salvation. The practice of ritual and the learning and the revelation that can come is what will help me receive a place of salvation. But there are people who could attend the temple every day who live a hellish existence and grasp in frustration for something that will somehow change that. There is nothing inherent in the temple that's going to change that. It's what can happen if you sink into things and let things come to you. And there are countless people who never knew of the temple or will ever know, and they are saviors, and they are a place of salvation. Nothing I do there will free anyone else or unlock anyone else. I know there's rhetoric like that. That's just ridiculous. The only person who is freed is me, and that is only if I see things that connect me and free me from thinking such destructive things that being in this space of ritual can help me see beyond. And one of the things that I think it's important that we recognize the power of carrying a name. We go in there, and every time we go, we have the name of someone else. We may know them, we may not know them, but it's the name of someone else that may have lived centuries before, may have died the year before, may have lived on the other side of the world. But several times we speak that name. And this is something else that I've seen in many cultures, this power of a name, this power of having a name written and having a name spoken. In Egypt, I was amazed that one way that you took power over someone else is you obliterate their name. You make it so it can never be seen, it can never be spoken. One way classes took power over those that they saw as lower than themselves, they obliterated the possibility that someone could leave their name written. That's the power of a name. And so this ritual of taking a name in and speaking it has this incredible experience where in that moment that I hold a name, I am them. And they are me. And across time and distance, I become connected and aware and a witness. And they become mine. And that is an incredible experience for me. Because by doing that there and allowing them to reach back through the veil and me to reach forward through the veil, I experience something that I feel Christ is an example of. That our hearts become one and we become not only a part of each other, we become aware and a part of the covenant we make as human beings to share burdens, to share joys, and to help each other on the journey. And we may not know exactly how, we just trust that we are connected and nothing has the power to divide us. And so that kind of vicarious work has spilled out into many areas of my life. When I went to the Women's March in D.C., I made prayer flags, and anyone who wanted to go but couldn't be there, they gave me their names, and I wrote them on these prayer flags. And I carried hundreds of names with me on that march because vicariously they were there with me, and I was there with them, sharing the journey at a time when I felt so hopeless about so many things. I received this strength to know that all of us were connected, not knowing exactly how we were going to move forward, but knowing that we were moving forward together. So that alone is salvation to me. There may be seasons where the temple can be powerful, and there may be seasons where it wasn't, wouldn't be. Just be in the season. Again, let it be there for you. If it's not, there's nothing wrong with that. Okay, so we spoke of Adam and Eve, and for years now, so much of what works for me is to be every part. And one of the things that I've started to see works for me in the temple is not only, okay, am I Adam this time? Am I Eve? Am I Elohim? Am I Jehovah? Am I Satan? Am I the garden? Am I the messenger? But to see that I'm all of it. So that this aspect that we have in ourselves, this aspect that loves to be in the garden, we love not to be responsible. We love to be told exactly how things are going to go. We love to have this exact, here's how it is, this is what you do, and then you do this. And this is exactly who you are. You don't need to worry about anything else. There's a part of us that loves that, and there's a part of us that's going, there's something more. I don't know what it is, but there's something more. And there's a part of us that's going, yeah, there is something more. And if you just do what I tell you, you'll get there. Just do what I tell you. Let's just go forward and just do what I tell you, but only do what I tell you. And there's a part of us that's recognizing all of that. And we're just doing our best to hold it all together and to guide as we get those points, get to those points where we're going, maybe this. And when we think that we've got to rip those parts apart and be separate and not acknowledge that this is all part of us, it is really painful. And at some point, but part of the journey, at some point we see that all of those parts can be worked together and bring us forward, because all of the aspects are of God. So did I mention that I did this paper, They, Them, Theirs, yesterday? No, okay, so yesterday I did this paper called They, Them, Theirs, about God on the spectrum. Part of it is acknowledging that all things, all qualities that we can have language for about God are a part of God and inherently a part of all of us. We've gendered them and polarized them. But again, this process, this ritual that reminds us, let's bring it all together and acknowledge all of it and see where we can go on the journey as we unify all this, is really powerful. And something to think about as far as the power of this story, it's in Star Wars. It's in Moana. It's in Doctor Strange. It's in Iron Man. This is the hero's journey that speaks to all of us. And we can make it true, or we can just see how it works and the power it has for us to learn. Some of the things that I would like us to consider is would be, well, for instance, the training for temple workers is evolving, and I'm really glad, because it also shows to me, reminds me, that the ritual itself is evolving. Because I do think there are parts of it that just don't contribute. There are plenty of things that could become more powerful, but in this place, as an ordinance worker there, my job is to create space for whoever walks into that building, and it doesn't matter who they are, it doesn't matter how they're dressed, it doesn't matter anything. I am really grateful that we have new training films that just keep emphasizing the moment someone is in that door, you just take care of them. You just create a place where they have their own experience. And you don't fuss about anything. You trust that they're doing the best they can. You don't force them to do anything. You don't insist they do anything. You just let what happens happen. You know the process that you're supposed to be doing, but you let them have their experience. And I'm really, really grateful for that. I think it's important that we see that elsewhere. It's helped me practice it more outside as well. Again, another important part of what can become great about this repetitive ritual. Really wonderful things have happened for me, and I'll just share a few of them. We talked about initiatory in this wonderful place of incredible promises that are given to us. And in the repetition, because obviously as an ordinance worker, it's a different kind of repetition than if I'm going there as an attendant, or as we call them, patrons. I just, you know, get sexist language. And but one time, when for the umpteenth time in a certain period of time, I was pronouncing an ordinance, and it, these blessings of being clean, these glorious, glorious blessings from blood and sins of this generation, yet I'm pronouncing them on people who technically are no longer alive. Well, which generation? This one? The one they lived in? All these different things. And all of a sudden, something just poured into me. It was this moment where it wasn't the actual ritual, it was the performance of the ritual and the repetition. I was in a space where noise was shut out. And all this stuff poured into me. And I could see generations of people who did things that are still impacting us. Horrible things. Terrible things that have drawn so much, spilled so much blood, have destroyed so many lives, caused so much heartache. And they lived generations ago. Specific people flooding into me. And what came to mind is completing your work on the earth. Their work is not done and will not be done until we are cleansed. And it's our part too. recognize how past generations have done things that hurt us now, for whatever reason, wherever they came from. We don't know. But what I got is there they were, desperately reaching through to help cleanse us from things they did that we continue now because we haven't forgiven, we haven't let go, and we haven't cleansed them or ourselves. This is a powerful thing that can happen when we sink into a ritual and let ourselves open up to something that provides power to us to be clean. No matter how much we pronounce something on each other, we need to receive it. We need to receive salvation ourselves and be in a place where we will. The idea of multiply and replenish being pronounced on people where
they're dead.
They're not only are they dead, many people who never could bear children. So what is it about? And that began the process of me seeing that inspiration, the actual breathing of life, is how we multiply and replenish. It has nothing to do with a birth canal or a dilated cervix or the ability to actually have some kind of bipolar intercourse. It has to do with us, the way our heavenly parents became parents to us. It wasn't because our heavenly mother went through eternal pregnancy. It's because we heard her speak words that brought us a quickening of life and thought. We were inspired to a new life. So being able to sink into that ritual and see new aspects of bringing life into the world is the act of salvation. And then, again, this reminder of letting go of what's true or correct or saving. Last year, we were at the top of Trail Ridge Summit in Rocky Mountain National Park. Mike was riding his bike through there. And a whole bunch of people were there. It was the visitor center and everything. And as I was sitting there waiting for him to get, you know, ride his bike up to the top, I noticed a man who was walking by me, and he had this very worn shirt on that had kind of holes and rips in it, and it was really dirty. And I look at it, and I realized this is a garment top that he's wearing as a shirt. And if I had somehow seen the essence of the temple as being inherently true, or this is inherently being a sacred thing, it would have been a moment of being upset or offended or something. And I know people who would feel that. All I could see is this wonderful representation. This is a man who obviously was in need of clothing and somehow had this garment top. That was it. That was, you know, that's what he was wearing. And whatever way he had this, or whatever he understood it to be, I saw that this clothing was sacred because it was protecting him from the elements. And I saw him as being clothed in a holy way because this is God. This man, who only had this torn, dirty piece of garment with unkempt hair and a beard, and this was God. And who else to wear holy clothing than God, who needed to be clothed? So in my experience of seeing that everything is vicarious, this is always God in front of me. This is God who is hungry and hopeless and begging to be seen and witnessed and loved. And this practice of vicarious work is sacred in that sense, because we are not doing vicarious work to provide salvation for someone else. We are doing it to provide it for ourselves. The week after the policy announcement, I went to do my shift at the temple, and I was really in a tough place. And normally, you can't sandblast the smile off me when I'm in the temple doing ordinance work. I love it. I really have come to love it. But I came in, I was barely walking. I was really in a tough place and wondered if I could even go. And my shift coordinator, who I consider my sister, took me aside. She took me off my first assignment and took me in to the children's room at the temple, where we bring the children who are doing sealing work. And I'm surrounded by pictures of Jesus holding kids on its lap. And she said, "What is wrong? What is going on?" And I just spilled. I said, this may be the last time I come here. I don't know what this means. I really don't know what will happen because of this awful, awful, unchristlike, terrible, destructive thing. And I don't know what it's going to take for me to work through this, and I don't know what's going to happen. But I cannot make a choice between who I know God loves and this. And bless her, she did not explain anything. She didn't do anything. She did exactly what we're trained to do in the temple, which is to trust me to have my own experience. And she said, "You take all the time you want. All I can tell you is God knows you and loves you. Just as God loves every single one of us. You take all the time you want. You do any assignment you want. Don't do any assignment you want. Be wherever you want to be. Because I know God loves you and will let you know." And I went into the celestial room. I couldn't be looking at any pictures. I couldn't be listening to anything. And I went in and sat there for a long, long, long time. And really went through all kinds of different conversations with God, with my dad, with all the people I felt close to me in the temple. And then I just sat quiet and listened. And again, what came is, "I'm with you, and this hurts, and I hurt. I hurt because of this. I hurt because of this." And you can do whatever you feel you need to do. And if you are here, there are people who are here hurting, and they need you, and I will help you. There's work to do. And I knew I could leave. I knew I could walk out, and that would be fine with me, with God, with anyone. And I knew that I needed the ritual, where I could get it. I didn't know if it would continue there or not. At that moment, I didn't. But in that moment, I went in and I did initiatories. And what I noticed is, I performed initiatories. Normally, we do initiatory assignments 30 to 60 minutes at a time. I was in there for 2.5 hours. And I noticed women, I really looked at them as they came in, and I sensed something. It's almost like a part of them was talking to me. And I realized there were women who were there who were going to be there for the last time. And they came because they knew they were there for the last time. And as I laid my hands on their head and pronounced these glorious blessings, I saw that I was pronouncing them through them, and they would then carry them out to everybody else in their life. That what I was saying to them, they would say to others somehow. That they would bless others provide redemption for others through this blessing as being one figurative way that that would happen. And that somehow it would reach everybody, whether in this life or in the next. Make it what you will, but whatever you do and wherever you go, let this be a blessing in whatever way that you carry it out to everybody in your life.